Welcome to the Entrepreneurial Mindset Podcast, where I interview industry leaders to show how an entrepreneurial mindset is a critical aspect of success in most endeavors. Today, I'm interviewing Misha Kuznetsov, a world-renowned tennis coach well-known for coaching 19-year-old U.S. tennis phenom, currently ranked number 67 in the world, Francis Tiafoe. Misha coached Francis for over a decade leading up to the early stages of his professional career and helped Francis become the youngest winner in the history of the most prestigious junior tennis tournament, the Orange Bowl. Misha is a former NCAA men's Division I tennis player and was a highly ranked junior player in Russia. In addition to his accomplishments coaching at the professional level, Misha has helped thousands of juniors obtain college scholarships and tennis accolades. Misha, how's it going today?
Hey, excellent, Jake. Thank you for asking, and thank you for a great introduction.
No problem. So tell us a little bit more about your background.
Oh, I can tell you a lot about my background. I can probably write a book about that, but I'll tell you just a little bit about that. Well, I was born in Russia, in Moscow, the capital, and started playing tennis at about probably age of 5 or 6, but just a little bit, hitting at the wall, hitting a little bit with my dad, and started taking lessons when I was about 7 years old. And my dad was a driven force and really wanted me to play tennis because he was kind of a tennis fanatic. And, you know, he put me in it was during communism back in Russia, so he put me in a tennis school maybe about twice a week for about an hour so I could learn tennis. And the groups were big, about 16 players on one tennis court, and it was called Tennis 1 and Tennis 2. I was in Tennis 2. Tennis 2 did just fitness, and we did not do any tennis. We had rackets, and we brought a tennis ball. Every player used to just bring one tennis ball, and they would put their name on it because we didn't have many tennis balls. The economy was bad, and nobody could find them. So you really tried not to lose that ball. So I was in Tennis 2 for a while where I didn't see tennis balls or tennis rackets. Just did a lot of fitness, and I was the smallest one. I was probably, well, when they lined us up, it was about 16 of us in line. I was probably about number 14 or 15 and towards the end of the line, and just really small and weak. Because my parents are pretty short, and I wasn't sure if I was going to stick around in that group because they would cut the players, you know, like months later we started with fitness. Say you couldn't jump far enough, and then, you know, they would measure in meters how far you're jumping, and then if you couldn't run long enough or it was a lot of also sit-ups, a lot of kangaroos, there were push-ups, and there were tons of crunches, but really working on your abs. And they wanted us to meet a certain number. And then if you didn't meet a certain number, they would send about 4 kids home. And then they just say, look, try something else. You know, they would tell kids, try ballroom dancing or try maybe swimming. So they would cut the groups, and I was out there for a while and trying to make it, barely made the cut a couple of times. And then was working hard, was hitting a lot of balls with my dad and trying to get stronger. And he was working me out on the track, and back then I was only about 7-8 years old. And then my dad kept working with me, put me in different groups. You know, I played tournaments, but all the tournaments were major tournaments in Russia, like here is the National Open, the Super National. In Russia would be like, say, one tournament a month or one tournament every 2 months, and everybody played. Like Yuzhny played, Tursunov, the best guys in Russia. Safin played age group higher than me. So I would play Mikhail Yuzhny. He was top 10 in the world for about, you know, top 20 for about 10 years. And then I would probably get to about second or third round at the best because all the major players were there, you know. And the level was really high. It was really hard to get into those tournaments. And did the best I could, got to about number 30 in Russia. And then used those results to get into a tennis academy in 98 and mailed a bunch of my resumes and paperwork to different academies like John Newcomb, Bollettieri. You know, I was able to get a 50% scholarship at Rick Macy Tennis Academy. When I was 17, turning 18, you know, I found a full scholarship to University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and played number 2 there. Did pretty well. You know, we did not play a tougher schedule because the conference was weaker than most, but we played some of the top teams, and I did, you know, I did okay. And then I always wanted to coach tennis, and started kind of my coaching career was actually my coaching career started when I was in Russia. Even in the middle school, I would teach my friends. They wanted to learn how to play tennis, so I'd take them to the wall and on the court, just the local court. We didn't have a net, so we would put a rope. So the rope was as a net, and we used the rope as a net. And then the lines were pretty bad. The paint would come off. So we put the lines with chalk.
Wow.
And then we measured it because all lines were in. Put lines with chalk. We had balls during Russia time. The Soviet Union tennis balls were not yellow. Actually, they were white. And they had either Russian writing on it or something like that. And they were pretty dead. But we were happy to have any tennis balls that had fuzz on them. And basically, you know, I taught my friends, and then I went to practices after school, and that kind of kept me out of trouble. And my friends went out and played afterwards, and every day I had to go to practice, and I took a bus or trolley bus, and then took a metro for probably about 40 minutes. Then I switched stations, took another metro, and then I had to go to the tennis center. There was two options, either 10-15 minute walk or wait for the bus, but the bus only came every half an hour, and you don't want to be late to practice, trust me. So then what happened was, a lot of times I was a little late. I just jogged those last 15 minutes. That was my warm up. And sometimes it was in the cold weather, you know, 0 Fahrenheit, you know, negative 20 Celsius. You're out there running, trying to get to practice. And then I did the same commute back, which was about an hour and a half, 3-4 days a week. So that's mental toughness right there for you, and you kind of being brought up in that kind of environment, it really teaches you when you come to America, for example, to appreciate things, mm-hmm. you know, things like, you know, food and good tennis balls and Gatorade, because, you know, players had Gatorade here and I had water, but I wanted to win so badly, and I really wanted to get that W because I didn't have Gatorade and I didn't have Nike or shoes. You know, my dad bought me shoes. They were secondhand shoes that were used. You know, I made the most of it, and hunger was there. And then a lot of Eastern European players come from a background similar to mine. So that was kind of the upbringing, and a lot of coaching back in Russia for fun. And then when I played Futures in California and those junior tournaments there, I would coach at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley tennis courts, and just coach different professors and try to hustle for money, get a little $20-$30 an hour there, and I loved it there because it's good money. And then I'd buy myself something nice and go downtown and get pizza and stuff. So that kind of, I really liked the taste of money and just kind of being able to have my own money back then. And continued coaching when I was in college during summers in Florida. First was my initial coach. During summertime and during wintertime, did some camps in Florida the first year, and then met my dad got a job in Pittsburgh, moved out there, and met this guy named Craig Perry, and he let me train in his clinics, and then I worked really hard, and then he gave me a job being a hitting partner, and then later on I became coach working for him, spent about 2 years working for him, and the first 6 months when I was out of college, and following that I received a job working at university, Robert Morris University is a Division I school, and I became a head coach, youngest head coach for Division I in the country at 23 years old.
When you decided to become a tennis coach, I want to know a little bit more about how you're able to establish your personal brand and your business during the early days starting out after you graduated from college.
When I graduated from college, I didn't have a job and I didn't have a place to go. So I went to Pittsburgh and I started living with my parents. And I didn't have a job or anything. And I went to a park and played with my dad. And I decided to start getting my name out there and advertising. And I met this guy, his name was John Valentich, he's a tennis fanatic, he just played at the parks. And he had a newsletter that he wrote for players in Pittsburgh, and I decided, well, I hit with them and, you know, did a few lessons, just kind of, you know, like entry level. And then I asked him if he could put me in his newsletter, and he was really excited to do so. And my rate was great. Most coaches at clubs in Pittsburgh area charged about $60 an hour. I would think I was charging 25. Then later on, I went to $30 an hour. But like even before meeting him, I just send out, you know, emails to places, and just when people were hitting at the wall or hitting, I would walk up and be like, do you want a lesson? And then one high school coach, I think it was Perrysville, Perry Avenue, near the stadium at Pittsburgh, he saw me and he offered me $15 an hour, and he said, look, would you coach my high school team? And he had guys come in and chip in $3, $4 and whatever. And we would go for 2-3 hours. I fed balls and we played games and I coached them. So that guaranteed me about 2-3 hours a day. And then I met some, you know, older man at the wall. And he did about 1.5, 2 hours a day with me, paid me $15 an hour. So that was the beginning stages. And then when that newsletter came out with my email on it, people started to write to me, adults, some juniors, they liked the rate. And I put down, you know, I play college tennis, I played Division One. I'm here for the summer. And people started to write, and I started to work, and I created business cards, and I created, you know, something like a flyer I would hand out and just posted places and started going to different parks. And kind of that was the beginning, Jake.
So you were charging almost very, very little when you were starting out, and you were just trying to build yourself up with your clientele. You only had charging $15 to $25 an hour. Now for your lessons, you charge, I think you charge at least $100 an hour for a lot of your lessons. So you've come a long way. You've created amazing tennis players, and you've coached some great teams and just a wide variety of players. And so just want to get your opinion on what a typical career path looks like for a tennis coach, in your opinion.
Well, a typical career path for a tennis coach, Jake, you mean in America or overall?
In America.
In America, this is what usually happens. Person decides to be tennis coach, so they figure they need to teach at the club level or junior. So usually you go to a tennis club and you get a job. In order to get those jobs, you have to get certified. So people go and then they take classes and they get different levels of certification they have to pass with serves and returns, the playing, the tennis lesson, the group lesson, video lesson, talking. So they get certified and they get one of those USTA certifications, either PTR or USPTA. Then they get a job at the club and then they try to work their way up from a staff coach to maybe senior coach, and possibly like down the road, 10, 15 years or whatever it takes to be a director or switch clubs. And that's how they make a living. And that's a typical career path usually for a tennis coach in America.
But you didn't go that way. Yours was different. I mean, you didn't stay as long at a club. You got to a tennis academy a lot sooner, right?
Yeah, well, first of all, I took for longest time ever. I wasn't even certified. When I was in college hitting tennis balls and working with Craig Perry in Pittsburgh, I consider him to be one of the best coaches in the United States. I don't think Craig was certified, and he's not certified, maybe not even now. I mean, maybe at some point he had some sort of certification or whatnot. But he was coaching unbelievable and quality was great, and I was doing the same drills as him. So for the longest time, I was learning from him and also from another coach in Florida. His name is Andre Kozlov. He's, his son won an orange ball, and he's, I think, about close to 100 in the world now, one of the best American tennis players for the last 10 years. His dad developed him. I don't think he's certified. I'm not sure Richard Williams is certified, or any of those guys that are actually like major, you know. So it's just kind of, you know, you work with players, and certified or not, as long as you're a good coach, people know about you. And if you're training good players, they want you to go to certain places, and eventually you do that. But the typical path, like you said, that's exactly, you know, that's what the club is required. So that's what those people do. But mine was atypical because, I mean, I'm a little bit atypical person as well.
So it sounds like what you were saying about the top coaches in the world, though, they don't need certifications. If you're going to be a great coach, a certification doesn't matter.
Correct, Jake. Certification doesn't matter. Like, you look at the best coaches, actually, they were not the best players. Like Nick Baltieri, for example, the guy was a paratrooper. You know, he jumped with a parachute and he became probably one of the best, maybe the best coach in the world right now. And then the next guy that I met was Rick Macy. He played Division III basketball, and he actually started coaching back in Pittsburgh at Shadyside Academy out there. And then he's the one that developed Capriati, Venus, and Serena, worked a little bit with Roddick, and had a major academy. He was considered to be number two best coach in the world. He got certified later on and started getting involved with more with USPTA and kind of teaching, you know, seminars and clinics. You need certification, of course, for that and the paperwork. If you're trying to move a different route in, like, management, and if you're trying to work with USTA more, then, of course, you need certain degrees of education. But if you're just trying to coach tennis and make players, whether you're certified or not doesn't really matter.
Okay, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about you coaching Francis Tiafoe to such a high level while helping so many other great players at the same time. How were you able to coach him and then also do really well coaching at a tennis academy at the same time? How did that work in the early days?
Yeah, in order to find balance, actually, it wasn't as hard as it sounds. The way to find balance was, for me, I took it one day at a time. And when I started working with him, he was very young, so it didn't require that much. And he was 8, so he was already in the clinic, and then 6 to 8 with the junior champions. And then he would follow me from clinic to clinic when I worked with other players, and I let him in. You know, and then I did some extra work with him, of course. So he kind of, I balanced it out that way. And I had players I was mentoring. Usually I gave them private lessons and coached them in the clinics. And the academy was set up that I had morning hours, and Francis was in school. So the early years were okay because he was in school in the mornings. And then there was so many hours on the court, it was easy to balance. Later on, when he became a full-time player, there were still several clinics a day. If he was an 8 o'clock clinic, I had other players that, you know, if he was 8 and 2, then I had other players 10 and 4. Then I had weekends and then tournaments. So I did a pretty good job managing that, and also other highly ranked players. At one year, I had about 5 players in top 10 in the nation in the United States at the same time. And there was some maintenance there, especially with the parents. And you work hard and you put them all together. You train them as a group. They push each other. So that's how it was. And basically it was a progression coaching him. And then when he got better, then he was – sometimes he trained less and did more fitness. And sometimes we put him in school. And then it's just basically spending so much time, 6 days – well, I spent 6 days a week probably almost – I mean 6 days a week, full days at the tennis center there. So just by putting so many hours in, I was able to balance it all.
Wanted to ask you about more directly about your coaching and what you think the single strongest skill is that has helped you be an extremely successful coach.
I would say it's a combination. The single strongest skill, I would put it, it's like reading that book, Talent is Overrated, that talks about becoming something, an expert in something, and not just another person just becoming unbelievable at what you do, doesn't really come from one single skill. It comes with a combination of things. So I would say, basically, in the word skill, I would describe background, where you're coming from, that influences that particular skill that you're going to come up with, the culture. In my case, it was learning to appreciate things and coming from Russia, and then hunger, basically trying to make it out there. And it's just a combination of those things, you know. I would call it deliberate practice. That would probably be how I would call that strongest skill. Under deliberate practice, I would put all those things in there, you know, because it's deliberate practice. But deliberate practice is practicing with hunger, you know?
You got to really want it.
Appreciating things, picking up balls, running around, hustling, gaining experience, you know, love and passion day in and day out. Not giving up, not letting people influence your life. being your own person, having your own personality, trying things, failing, and coming back up.
Yeah, I definitely agree. What's one daily habit that you have that helps you significantly with your tennis coaching?
Well, I have a couple of habits, but I like analyzing matches on TV and just seeing what other players do. I like to do it most days. Well, when my mind is fresh, sometimes I guess too much. But every day, what I like to do as well as analyze matches is making a plan while I'm driving in a car in the morning. So that's probably that single one daily habit would be probably making a plan in the car and kind of like also doing a lot of reading, doing a lot of tennis reading. I would say reading, analyzing matches, and definitely making a plan in the car. That would be the top three.
So what advice would you give to someone entering high school today that wants to pursue a life as a tennis coach?
Yeah, well, the person first have to figure out whether they want to coach juniors or adults or combination of both, or entering high school, I would say long-term vision.
Okay.
Long-term vision, building players, building name. Or the second option, they could pursue USPTA or PTR level career and teach at the club and make a decent living doing that.
What if they want to be like you and coach someone at the professional level?
Well, go to work, get young kids, 6, 7 years old, start putting hours in, talk to their parents, work them for free if you have to, get them to tournaments, go to tournaments for free, meet other people, and just keep doing it over and over. Get 10 of them. Get 10 6, 7 mm-hmm. year olds. I think if I were to get about 20 little ones, I can probably get about 15, 17, 17 of them to college, play Division I tennis and get scholarships. If I get them early enough and they stick with me and play tennis 3, 4 days a week, that or better. So a young person, that would be a great start.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to my interview with Misha Kuznetsov. If you'd like to connect with Misha or learn more about him, you can do so through his website at mishatennis.com. That's mishatennis.com. Also, if you're an industry leader or you know someone that's an industry leader with an admirable entrepreneurial mindset and you'd like to recommend that person to be on the podcast, you can contact me at jake@temindset.com. That's jake@temindset.com.